Hello and welcome to The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, where we explore the culinary arts in and around the greater Lehigh Valley. I'm Mike Drabenstadt, your host for our gastronomic tour of our region's amazing food scene. I'm here with Rachel Griffith from Apollo Grill, a fine dining establishment in downtown Bethlehem, and Rachel has been general manager of Apollo for 10 years and is slated to become the new owner at the end of this year. Rachel, welcome to The Inside Dish.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So Apollo has been a fixture on the Lehigh Valley restaurant scene since opening nearly 20 years ago, and dozens of restaurants have come and gone during that time in Bethlehem and throughout the valley. What's been the secret to Apollo's longevity?
I believe the secret is, you know, we're well-versed in our philosophy that do what you love and do it well. We have amazing, consistent food, quality food, wonderful service. We really reach out to the community. You know, we definitely believe that you need the community support. So charity work and, you know, nonprofit work is huge to us as well. It also, you know, stems from our owners. You know, there's four of them that have been very involved for the last 19 years. And they have taught us, you know, everything that we know, everything that I know, which is phenomenal.
And it's been 19 years. How has Apollo changed, or has it changed in the time you've been there? You've been really close for the last 10 years.
Right, yes. We haven't changed too much. Obviously, we keep up with the dining scene, you know, and we also do small renovations around the restaurant. But our recipes, you know, we've had items on our menu that have been there since day one. But of course, we believe in a well-balanced menu. So we do try new things out, different types of cuisine, see what works, see what doesn't, see what people like, what they don't like. But we definitely keep the main, you know, entrees and appetizers on that menu, and those don't change.
Well, in fact, I was going to ask, to what extent, from a cuisine standpoint, do you look to balance some of that consistency and the expectations where people come in and expect to see a certain dish on the menu, whether it's for lunch or dinner, and introducing them to some new concepts? How do you find that balance?
Well, we've had some some times where we have tried to take an item off, and we have heard about it, so that item does come right back on the menu. But of course, you know, people are open, you know, to trying new things. But we do try to maintain what people are used to, what they know, what the Apollo, you know, stands for, with our appetizers and, you know, all of that good stuff.
And how would you classify what it stands for from a cuisine standpoint? How would you describe it to someone who hasn't been?
You know, I would say more like American, but we also have flavors of, you know, we have Asian flavors, Italian flavors, you know, everything. What's great about our menu is that there's something for everybody.
And even though it has this kind of core kind of American center point, I was going to say that sometimes you'll find pot stickers, or sometimes you'll find something with an Italian flavor. So that allows people to explore different cuisines without straying too far from the middle ground.
Right, exactly. We have some amazing nachos, but we have amazing Asian lettuce wraps and a Japanese pancake and a great angel hair pasta. So
now, certainly in the last 19 years, there's been a lot more outgrowth and competition in the Lehigh Valley, which is one of the reasons we have the show, that we can talk about it and explore it. How has Apollo been able to retain some of that distinctiveness and competitiveness over that time when we've seen such an explosion here in the Lehigh Valley?
You know, we believe in going above and beyond. You know, every single person that walks into that restaurant is important to us, and customer-wise, but also staff-wise. You know, the general manager, the owners, and our dishwashers, and our servers, and our bartenders, you know, everybody works together to maintain that same vision, you know, going above and beyond, loving what you do, and it shows, and we showcase it as best as we possibly can. So our level of expectations for our staff coming in and our current, you know, our staff that has been there a while is you just have to go 110% all the time. There's no off day. You can't have it.
Well, I know you mentioned staff that has been there for a while. I know the restaurant industry is rife with a lot of turnover, but the times I've been to Apollo, there are people I've recognized year after year who have been there. And I imagine that longevity is important to maintaining that quality of service too.
Oh my gosh, yes. You know, Apollo is not one person. It's everybody. You know, it's all of our staff. And, you know, the fact that we've had servers that have been there 10, 15, some 19 years, that's huge. You don't see that anywhere. We definitely have something special.
speaking of servers, how difficult is it to find good servers here in the Lehigh Valley? I've talked to other restaurateurs who have said it's difficult to find a higher level of service like you might find in Philly or New York or other metropolitan areas. Is that something that you've experienced and dealt with? And if so, how have you overcome that?
I definitely have seen that, especially with the explosion of the restaurant scene. You know, there's a lot of restaurants now. So you don't see as many people looking for serving, you know, careers because they're at other restaurants. But there's one thing, you know, we have consistent business, you know, so it's very comforting for somebody coming from another restaurant knowing that, well, you know, the Apollo Grill, you know, we maintain our customers and we're always busy, you know, for the most part. So you're able to kind of, you know that you're going to be, you'll be doing well and you'll be in safe hands. You'll have, you know, wonderful customers that you're dealing with, great staff. But we definitely have a, I would say a tougher training program because we need to make sure that the people that we're bringing in share the same values as we do. And sometimes that's hard to find. But you do, when you do find those people, you know they're going to be part of the team for a while.
I'm sure listeners would be curious. We've all been served by good servers before. For someone who's serving full-time as their primary job, what sort of money can they make per week? I'm sure there's a range based on tips and if they work lunch or dinner, but I'm kind of curious.
You know, I mean, it's definitely depending if they work, you know, part-time or full-time. But I would say a full-time server could probably make, you know, between $800 and $1,000 a week doing what, you know, doing with a consistent schedule with mm-hmm. a couple of weekend nights. Absolutely.
And especially if they've been there, they have a clientele.
Absolutely.
And they're good at what
yes.
they do.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
And what are the most challenging parts of running a restaurant these days, considering that you're going to be not just running it, but owning it sometime soon?
You know, I guess maybe it's not necessarily a challenge, but what I love about it, it's the fact that every day is different. You know, your priorities constantly change. You have to be thinking seven steps ahead to make sure that, you know, everything is going smoothly. Probably, I think the most difficult part is making sure that you prioritize properly and that your head is on a swivel, that you don't miss something. I think the biggest challenge is you don't want to miss something. So I do my best to, you know, keep on going.
And I imagine it's not just missing the big things, but missing
a detail,
smaller little details.
Yeah. It's all about the details in dining, in restaurants, in food service, and hospitality. You know, we always say that an experience is made of 100 details, you know? So if the little dot on the plate of sauce is not correct, you know, it bothers you. So you always want to make sure everything is perfect.
And it's everything from music to food to service, even to how
right.
the bathrooms look.
From start to finish.
Now, is that especially difficult for a general manager where you need to have an idea of decor, ambiance, service, cuisine, and kind of have knowledge of all these things and how they come together?
Yeah, you absolutely do. You know, I like to, I do say, though, I feel like I cheated these last almost, you know, 10 and a half years because I've had these amazing bosses that, you know, have literally taught me everything. You know, I'm sure you know Rod and Diane Holt and then Patty and Tucker Lyons. You know, they just have taught me everything. And when you have such mentors like that, it really makes you a strong person. In fact, like, I want to work hard because of them, because they are so good to us and that they make us want to work harder and do a good job.
Were there specific lessons that you've learned from them over the past 10 years that really stick in your mind?
The details. You know, I mean, I was a very detail-oriented person prior to working at the Apollo Grill, but I thought, you know, when I was, you know, 21 years old coming in, that, like, I knew everything. You know, I worked at great restaurants, and then I went there. And then I realized at that point, now I know what it's like to be an awesome server, a great boss, and to see the whole picture. I got it then. It clicked.
Well, unless you've worked at a restaurant, sometimes you don't have an appreciation for some of those details or things that happen every shift. What's the one thing that you wish guests at your restaurant knew about the restaurant business that might give them an even greater appreciation of what happens? what kind of goes on either behind the scenes or things that they maybe don't see?
With the timing of everything, you know, I really sometimes it's hard to explain timing to every, you know, there's a system in place. There's reservation times for a reason. There's ticket times for a reason. You know, it's the timing. It's very hard when you're not in the restaurant industry to actually walk into a restaurant and understand how meticulous everything works, you know, and if hey, you need to make sure everything stays balanced. You know, that's why you don't take all 6 o'clock reservations, because if you took all 6 o'clock reservations and no 6:30 reservations, then the bartenders get hit, then the kitchen gets hit, then the bussers get hit, and everyone's getting up at the same time. So it's all about timing.
What do you see ahead for Apollo under your ownership? How do you see the restaurant maintaining some of what it has or maybe evolving over the long term?
You know, I definitely, you know, I don't want to change anything. You know, that restaurant runs perfectly how it is. My staff is amazing. The guys and girls in the kitchen are amazing. So I change-wise, there's nothing will be changed. Growth, you know, of course, you know, you want to see growth. You know, I plan on doing a few things, you know, that will definitely maybe bring in some more people or, you know, open our restaurant on maybe certain days that we weren't open, not often, but a few.
We still need a break.
yeah, absolutely. We need those 2 days off. So a few things here and there.
Do you anticipate any changes, not immediately, but long term, based on dining trends with millennials starting to make a little bit more money coming in, whether there are different dining habits there and baby boomers maybe finding other options or staying put? Do you see anything, immediate, but more long-term?
You know, you definitely have to pay attention to, you know, who's dining with you. You know, one thing about the Apollo is everybody dines with us. You know, it's not just millennials. It's not just baby boomers. It's everybody. So, you know, we definitely want to pay attention to that. And, of course, you know, I mean, as going out myself to different restaurants and, you know, in different cities, you know, you definitely will pick up on certain things that are becoming more of a trend. And that's the kind of those are the kind of things that we do want to stay on top of, because you don't want to fall behind. You always want to be a step ahead.
And finally, quickly, as an owner or manager, how do you know you're doing a good job?
The smiles on everybody's faces. You know, there's nothing better than somebody coming up to you at the end of their meal saying that they just had the best time ever. That just makes it all worth it, you know, and seeing your staff happy, 100% seeing your staff happy.
That's great. Rachel, thanks for your time here at WDIY on the Inside Dish. All the best.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
With the Apollo. I'm Mike Dravenstadt, and this is the Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Hello and welcome to the Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, where we explore the culinary arts in and around the greater Lehigh Valley. I'm Mike Dravenstadt, your host for our gastronomic tour of our region's amazing food scene. I'm here with Todd Allman, owner of Dunder & Heister, a sustainable whole animal butcher with locations in the Easton Public Market and a standalone location in Wyomissing at the southern end of our listening area. Todd, welcome to the Inside Dish.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Doing great. To the untrained eye, most meat might look alike. A pork shoulder or flank steak in your display case might look the same as one might see at Wegmans or ShopRite. What are the primary differences when meats are pasture-raised and sustainable?
Frankly, a lot. There's a big difference, and that's why we're in business and what we do. There's a belief that animals, if they're raised in the right way, can provide us nutrients and nourishing foods that make people feel happy and make them healthier.
And when you say the right way, what does that entail?
Yeah, I think it includes several things. I think it's having the right genetics of animals that can flourish on local pasture. I think it's what the animals are fed. We believe in something called body wisdom, that if animals are out on pasture, and they're given a diversity of things to eat, the animal knows at that exact time what it should be eating and what it can do to make itself be more healthy. And that's animal wisdom, that's body wisdom, whether it's animals or for humans. And then the third thing would be how the animals are cared for. If animals are raised right and treated well, and kind of that we're stewards for them, that ultimately that will lead to healthier meat that will sustain us and make us healthier.
When you talk about the idea of a sustainable butchery,
right,
what does that entail? What does the word sustainable mean in that context?
Well, one of my passion plays is, of course, the Pennsylvania Dutch, and believing that our area here, the sense of place, is pretty special. And one of the tenets of the Pennsylvania Dutch is they would have phrases like waste not, want not. It was a belief that you could make a little bit go a long way. And I think that is readily applicable to what we're doing, which is that we're using the whole animal in the traditions of the Pennsylvania Dutch. So once it's slaughtered, the animal comes in, and then we're butchering it and using all aspects of the animal, from tallow to lard to bone broth. So we think it's sustainable because it's very little waste, and we encourage our producers, our farmers, also to do things in environmentally sound ways, such as no pesticides or herbicides, and the animals are on pasture, and it's not very intensive. It's not intensive grazing. It's rotational grazing, and so that's sustainable as well. So it's kind of a full circle way to look at things.
Is there a difference between sustainable and organic?
Well, of course, organic is a structure from the United States government in terms of how to characterize food, and there's a certain protocols that go with that. As it relates to sustainable, I think that the idea there, and I would call that more regenerative, is a word that I like to use when it comes to agriculture. Regenerative means that you're allowing nature to take the course, and it's using what already exists in a low-intensity area, that man doesn't need technology, that if you allow grasses to grow and you put the animals on those pasture and you allow it to flourish, that's all you need to do. And so that's what I would consider, I would call it regenerative instead of sustainable, but they were pretty synonymous.
Now, you were talking earlier about using the whole animal, and one of my observations is that supermarkets might have a high quantity of a small number of cuts, where butchers like yourself would have maybe a small quantity of a large number of cuts, which I imagine is a reflection of the whole animal approach and something that shoppers might need a little bit of time to get used to.
Yes. Well, you know, if you go to, let's say, a wedding and there's 300 people there eating tenderloin, I think, you know, if you're in the butchery business, you sit back and go, wow, think of all the animals that you had to come from to do that. And I think for us, again, it's believing in the whole animal, that what we try to work with our customers, and we try to give them what I call a meat passport. So you want to, if a tenderloin isn't available, maybe you go with the faux filet, or you get them to learn more about eating different parts of the animal and kind of explore. And it's, many customers love that because it's exciting, new flavors, new tastes. And again, I would want to say to you that all of these things that we're discussing, it goes back to flavor. That this whole movement is about food, whole food that tastes the way nature intended. And so again, with the whole animal butchery, you're going to eat different cuts and allow that flavor to come through and have different textures and different techniques. But again, it's kind of trialing different things, and people are stayed and like, all I eat is a burger or a tenderloin. And our method allows people to kind of explore and learn about all the other great cuts that are out there.
Well, I imagine if you use a concept like a meat passport, that travel agent would be the butcher, right?
Yes. And in that metaphor, that is the case.
So talk a little bit about having a skilled butcher there to help guide people with cuts, either cuts they're familiar with or cuts they aren't, because that's something that a lot of times you don't get at more of a supermarket or mass-produced place.
Sure, that's a great question. And I think a lot of the reason why we started Dundurn Heister, when I was a kid, we would go to an old butcher shop in Wyomissing. We have a store there in Wyomissing as well as at the Easton Public Market. And it was called Banco's. And the butcher's name was Ray Luckenbill. And he was this Pennsylvania Dutch butcher. And I would go in there with my mom every Saturday. And the cases would look beautiful. And there was this man with a beard and a smile and a boisterous personality. And he would walk my mom through what to buy and what sauces to use and how long to cook it. And as I grew up and I lived elsewhere and moved back, We were frustrated that they're really the Bankos of old were gone. There are no longer, or there are very few of those remaining butchers that are experts and masters. And if you go to a local supermarket, most meat isn't even cut there anymore. It's cut in a plant many, many miles away. And so I think we wanted to bring that back and bring back that feeling, the relationship. There's a picture in my mind that we call the attentive butcher, of that well-respected man in the community reaching over the counter with kind eyes and an understanding look. And magic happens then when the customer says what they need and the butcher is able to provide them exactly that special cut for that occasion. There's something special that happens there, and I think that's what we're trying to recreate with our butcher shops.
Well, how educated are today's consumers about parts of the animal, about the way artisan butchery happens? Is this something that you have to educate, or they come looking for it when they come to Dunder and Heister?
Well, I think one of our main values, one of our tenets at Dunder and Heister, is education. We want to have our staff highly educated, and we want to have them there in a position to educate the consumer. I think we're in a society right now with do-it-yourself, and people want to learn. And I think from when we started to now, you've seen a huge upturn in what people know, but people are curious. I think our biggest thing that we offer is education, because people, even the innocuous pot roast can be pretty intimidating for people. Like, how do you make a pot roast? What is this whole braising thing? And so that's pretty valuable that we do, and we recognize that if you're going into a whole animal butcher shop, it can be intimidating. You walk in, you see all these cuts. What's a faux filet? What are these items? And I think that what we want to do is be able to educate the consumer, anticipate that they need understanding, and that we're there to help out.
Do you think that educational role is something where you're taking that on, where perhaps it was a generational thing years ago, where you might learn from mother or grandmother, where you had this nuclear family or people in the area? Now, people are a little more spread apart. They're not doing that. And perhaps that education is falling on people like yourself and maybe to some extent television food shows.
Right, yeah, the food shows are inspiring it, but I think you're exactly right. I think there's a whole generation of people. Like, I remember, because I'm in the business now, I think back to all that my mother did, but I went off, had another career, and I think that food was just about sustenance. It's something that you would just get because you were hungry and you would move on. And I think now as a society, it's more than that. It's more than sustenance. It's an experience. It's wanting to have the self-satisfaction of being able to cook yourself. And I think that that's really an important role, especially with everybody being so busy. I think the challenge is everybody wants to eat better, but they don't have a lot of time. And so it's up to companies like Dunder and Heister to help provide quick, convenient solutions that, oh, by the way, are healthy and local. So we're providing that service. We're getting them what they need and doing it in a quick, convenient way. So it's the best of both worlds, I think.
Well, speaking of quick and convenient, you don't just offer butchered meats at both locations. You have some prepared foods and sandwiches.
Right.
Talk a little bit more about the development of those and how they coincide with the sustainable whole animal butchery approach.
Sure. Well, I think first and foremost, beyond the concept of whole animal butchery, is that we want to be a one-stop shop for our customers. So we realize they're coming across town many times to buy that flank steak or that special cut. And we want to have convenient things that allow the individual, the customer, the guest, to make a meal. So that first and foremost. But in addition to that, because we're using the whole animal, it's up to us to be ingenious and to use the whole animal in creative ways, delicious ways, and ways that ultimately, again, make it a convenient solution for the customer.
I know earlier this year, I think it was over the summer, you had the opportunity to take part in a James Beard dinner in New York City.
That's right, yes.
Talk a little bit more about that. It sounds like something really special where Pennsylvania was represented.
Yeah, again, I think another inspiration for us and my passion play is the Pennsylvania Dutch Foodway. I believe that because of that foodway, much like other regional cuisines, there is a potential to have an economic effect on this community, that if we say eat like you live here, and the belief is that, you know, we're pretty lucky. We have amazing farms, some of the richest soil on the face of the earth, and we have a lot of history, a lot of heritage in how we eat. And I've always wanted to revive that, but revive the core elements of it, but make it work for modern day palates. And I've always admired Chef Lee Chismar from Belit Restaurant, fantastic chef. And very early on, we began collaborating and discussing ways that we might be able to do things that could help elevate the Pennsylvania Dutch food way into regional status. And by working together, Lee had always had opportunities to go up to James Beard, and we collaborated. It was his show, but it was our meets, and we brought a whole team from a local food historian, William Moyes Weaver, and other folks there along the way to tell this story, this what I believe very, very important story for our region of what it means to be from here and what it means to eat like you live here. And it was an honor to be up there in New York City and to have our food kind of achieve its rightful place among America's great regional cuisines.
Well, certainly if you're looking for someone to elevate the idea of Pennsylvania Dutch cooking, I can't think of someone better than Chef Chismar.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah.
Well, Todd, thank you for joining us here at WDIY and sharing your story at Dunder & Heister and everything that you're doing.
My pleasure. Thanks.
I'm Mike Dravenstadt, and this is The Inside Dish on Lehigh Valley Art Salon.